Well, in the old days, many radio superstars migrated into television, and they became huge hits as well. A lot of this happened a long, long time ago. Some of you might not even remember the old-time radio shows, but in a moment, we're going to talk with a vintage historian, John Tefteller. He remembers, and we'll talk with him about this next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. So if you're in the living room with your family, sitting around the old huge Magnavox radio, sit back and enjoy the show. Boy, that's what they did in the old days. John Tefteller is one of the world's leading experts in vintage sound recordings from the 20s to the 60s. He has collected original recordings of radio programs and blues and rock and roll records for 40-plus years. Started at the age of 16 as a part-time assistant to the comedian Groucho Marx. Tefteller creates and sells a yearly blues calendar as well, traveling all over the country and the world, searching for rare records, vintage photographs, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Hey, John, we're going to have some fun tonight.
Yeah, great. Hello, George, and hello, everybody on the Coast to Coast AM audience. Yes, we are going to have fun tonight.
Next time I go to Detroit, by the way, I need to look at my mother's old record collection. She still has the 78s.
Yes, well, 78s can be very valuable or they can be completely worthless. It just depends on what type of music she was into when she was buying those 78s.
Really? So what would be the very expensive type of music on the 78s?
The early blues, the early black music from the 1920s and 30s, some of the early jazz, and a little bit of the early country, but we're all talking about things from the Depression era, from mid-1920s to mid-1930s, basically.
I'm not sure she listened to that, but I'm going to have to look at all those because they're just classics.
Well, some of them, if they're the right blues records, can be very, very, very valuable in the tens of thousands of dollars.
John, I want to talk with you a little bit about the technology behind all of this because you have seen the metamorphosis and the progression from the records to the 8-tracks to the cassettes to the DVDs to where we are now with digital. Isn't that incredible the way technology has moved along these different areas?
Well, it's incredible, and in some ways it's not so good. Digital is fine if it's used properly, but digital has also been a way to kind of dumb down sound quality so that you can cram 10,000 songs onto an iPod at a very low level of sound quality. And that is training an entire generation of people to accept music and whatever else they may be cramming onto their iPods at a much lower quality than they could have if they had stayed with the older formats.
Now, where does the technology go 10 years from now? What's next?
Well, I don't really know. I tend to live in the past. So.
You're not a futurist.
No, I'm not a futurist. I'm only a futurist in the sense that I like to preserve things from the past so that people in the future can enjoy it. And that's what I've spent my life doing, is hunting down rare recordings and things that are either extremely rare or I was told did not exist. And I spent the time and the energy and the money traveling around the country proving people wrong that some of these things actually do exist. You just have to hunt them down and find them.
Later on, we're going to play some various clips from some old-time radio programs, some of which, of course, folks may have heard. Most probably did not, but they're all fascinating. How difficult is it for you, John, to track down these clips and these recordings that you've obtained?
Well, it depends on whether we're talking about the records, the commercial records that were sold to the public back then, or whether we're talking about the radio broadcasts, which were never sold to the public.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole different thing there. So you have to kind of tell me which of the two you want to talk about and in what order.
Yeah, well, let's say the old-time radio shows. How did you find those?
Okay, the old-time radio shows, they were, well, let's just put it this way. There's only about 10% of everything that was broadcast during what's called radio's golden age. And radio's golden age is what we call about 1930 to about 1960. The last programs went off the air in 1960, and the first network radio stuff was right around 1930. And of all of the shows that were broadcast during that time period, only about 10% of it exists today. The other 90% is lost to history. It's just gone. And there's a bunch of different reasons for that. Some of it's neglect, some of it's willful destruction, and some of it's just simply the fact that they weren't recorded in the first place. About 20% of what was on radio back then was never recorded in any way, shape, or form. The other 80% was recorded in the 30s and 40s on what are called electrical transcriptions, which are 16-inch platters, literally 16-inch records. That's 4 inches larger than a standard long play or LP record that really isn't being made too much anymore, but most people remember records. But these 16-inch electrical transcriptions were able to hold 15 minutes per side. And when the shows were broadcast, and 90% of the shows back then were broadcast live, there was not really pre-recorded radio for the most part. In fact, there were rules against pre-recorded radio.
Well, that's right. They did sound effects live, everything.
They did sound effects live. They did music live. It was as if you were producing an entire 15-minute half-hour or hour program live from start to finish with a whole bunch of people, a sound effects person, a script girl, the actors, the director, the producer, the announcers, the sound effects men, all that stuff, and it was all done live. And then they would record these things for various purposes, but not everything was recorded. And a whole lot has been lost, and a whole lot of it was due to carelessness and basically people at the networks back then who just didn't think anyone would ever care to hear these things again. And so they simply trashed the recordings. Some of them were recycled because they were made out of metal, and you could actually melt down the metal. So there were tens of thousands of them that were melted down for the metal content, for a few cents of metal. It's just sickening to know all of American history, sound history and radio history, that has been destroyed since it was broadcast.
I remember my parents had an old Philco, and it was like a piece of furniture, John. I mean, it was part of the living room.
Yes, well, the radio was your big piece of furniture in the living room, and the entire family would gather around the radio and listen to whatever program they agreed upon. And it was like television, but there wasn't like hundreds of channels to choose from.
And it brought the families closer, I bet.
Oh, absolutely. Radio was called the theater of the mind because you had to use your imagination to put faces and places to what you were hearing. The actors would be very good. In fact, they used some of the biggest Hollywood stars on a lot of the programs, and the actors were great, but you still had to imagine the scene. You had to work it out in your mind as they're telling you this story with sound effects and music.
You know, you're absolutely right. Many years ago, I turned down an offer from a cable network. They wanted to put a camera in my studio. And I said, no. I said, this program is the theater of the mind. You know, when we talk about supernatural and ghosts and things like that, I want people to sit back and imagine what's going on. And if there's a camera in the studio, John, especially for this kind of program, you know, this is, you know, we're non-political, and it's different where in those cases, the host is the show. Our topics drive this program. And, you know, I didn't want a camera in here. So we turned down a lot of money because of that. It would just spoil, I think, that the imagination. And I'm glad I did that.
Well, I've listened to your show on numerous occasions, and I totally agree with you, because what you want is you want people to use their imagination. And the topics that you cover on your show, a lot of them are things that definitely require a whole lot of imagination to get into.
That's right.
And the very best of old-time radio shows, to me, some of the very best ones of all time were the ones where they dealt with ghosts and monsters and aliens and all that kind of thing. And those shows are not dated. Even today, you can listen to them, and they're astonishingly good.
We're going to play a little clip of some work of Orson Welles, but I wanted to talk with you about War of the Worlds, because there's been some controversy about that, John, and you might be able to answer this for us. One was, I heard that the network tried to do this as almost a marketing ploy. They wanted to see the reaction of people. That was one. And then two, did people really go crazy over this show? I mean, were they that panicked?
Yeah, well, I actually deliberately did not give you a portion
right.
of War of the Worlds. Because that's kind of been played to death, although I'm sure there's those in your audience who've never heard it. But just so you can understand what happened, it was not deliberate at all. Orson Welles wrote the show as a sort of a news broadcast that was happening, but it was obviously a fake news broadcast if you paid attention to it from the very beginning of the show. The problem came in that Orson Welles did not have a big audience for his Mercury Theater on the air show that night when this was aired at first. The majority of the country was tuned to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. Now, most of your listeners aren't probably going to know who Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy were, but he was a ventriloquist and Charlie McCarthy was the dummy, and they had comedy routines with a ventriloquist on the radio, which seems a little bit odd, but it worked and the writing was very good and it was very funny. Well, that particular night on the Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy show, they brought on some sort of a singer who wasn't particularly good, and the audience, which was mostly up to that point, glued to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, all of a sudden switched the dial. And when they switched the dial, all they heard was what sounded like real news reports of Martians landing in New Jersey, and it panicked the nation because people believed it was happening.
Sure.
They didn't hear the show from the beginning. And all the way through, from that point to the end of the show, There were people that literally jumped out of windows, committed suicide. It was all kinds of horrible things happening, and Orson Welles was not aware of any of it until he started getting messages near the end of the show as people were panicking at the network as all these reports were coming in of people doing these crazy things as a result of the show. And he actually came on at the end of the show and said, you know, it is Halloween, and we were doing a kind of a little story here. And he tried to to wash it away, but the controversy of it was so great that show is remembered for now decades later.
I would guess the next day or the day after in the newspapers, it must have been a huge story then.
It was a gigantic story for days and days and days, and a bunch of rules were then written for radio shows that said that you had to make it very clear that you were doing dramatizations, and it basically changed the face of radio a little bit.
During the war, how important was radio?
Radio was as important as you could imagine because it was what let everyone in the United States know what was going on with the war, and most all of the dramatic programs and the comedy programs, most all of them would do war-related stories. So, for example, you would have Fibber McGee and Molly, which was a big popular comedy-type show. You would have them talk about rationing and black market meat and all this kind of thing, and all of the shows geared themselves towards getting the people psyched up for the war and in support of the war and going along with the rationing and all that. It was actually quite a bit of, you could call it propaganda, but it really kept the country in the wartime spirit during World War II.
Didn't it build the careers, John, of Edward R. Murrow and Walter Winchell and people
Absolutely.
Like that?
Absolutely, yes. There were a number of very famous newsman, and I guess Edward R. Murrow would be the most famous.
He sure was.
That started as World War II reporters and then went on to become very famous journalists in television later.
Huge correspondence, and you know, he'd be live from London and stuff. I want to play this real quick clip for you, which sets the stage, John. It's a news clip that I normally play on December 7th.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
I can imagine, John, sitting around the radio at night with people just in fear, gripping what could be going on worldwide, hearing your president come on and say that. It truly must have been emotional.
Oh, absolutely. And Roosevelt was really good at using radio to communicate what he was trying to tell the country. So, yes, no, definitely. That had the entire nation riveted to the radio to hear about the attack on Japan and what the United States was going to do in response.
I'm amazed at how some of the great old-time radio stars, the Arthur Godfreys, the Art Linkletters, and so many others that you have mentioned, made that transition into television because they needed talent, and so they just went from radio to TV. But what amazes me the most, John, is when I went back and looked at some of the TV clips of those old-time radio guys who went to television, I mean, their ages, like Jack Benny, for example, I mean, these were older people that would never happen today. You know, today the world is full of, you know, young demographics and things like that. Those guys never would have made it today on television. Isn't that amazing?
Well, yes, it is. The world is much, much different now than it was back then. And the world of entertainment is much different now than it was back then. Everybody wants the newest, hottest thing right now. And that new hot thing sometimes doesn't last very long. And then you've got a new hot thing. Whereas back in these old times we're talking about, you're talking about Jack Benny and Groucho Marx and the different comedians that started in vaudeville.
Yeah.
Even further back than radio, then they did film, then they did radio, then they did television, and then they became legends before they died,
yeah,
so to speak.
Some of the old-time game shows on television were originally on radio, too, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
Amazing. Amazing stuff. And you also collect these old-time records, as you were saying. You're into blues in a big way, aren't you?
Right, because of all of the styles of music from that late 20s, early 30s period, the rarest of them all is the early blues recordings. They were not sold in major numbers because of the prejudicial nature of the country. White people didn't really buy black blues records back then, so they were strictly targeted towards the African-American audience.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't sell very many of them because during that time, it was a depression, and of all the people in the country that were poor, African-Americans were some of the poorest, so they didn't have money to buy records. So those records tend to be extraordinarily rare. Not all of them, but a whole lot of them are, and some of them are so rare that they don't even exist today that we know of. And that's what I do, is I try to find those records that do not exist that we know of, to try to find them and re-release them as part of my company, Blues Images, where we do that. We go back and we find these records because there's no masters. Original masters on these things do not exist. They were destroyed long ago by the record companies. And so you have to go back and find the cleanest possible copy of a 78 RPM record and then remaster from there for re-release now.
How much did the little 33s go for when somebody came out like Elvis with a hit song?
Well, A 33 is an LP, and those didn't come out until the early 50s.
Okay.
The original recordings that were available to the public in the 20s, 30s, and 40s were 78 RPM records. In the late 40s, early 50s, the 45 RPM came out. Those sold for about 69, 79 cents. The 78s sold for anywhere from 50 cents to a dollar. And then when you got to the LPs, the long play records in the 50s, those were between $2.98 and $5.98, depending on a bunch of different factors.
Well, and now you can iTunes for 99 cents. John, we're going to talk much more with you about this, about some of the things that you've been doing. Later on tonight, we've got a number of old-time radio show clips I will play. And then, of course, in the final hour, we'll take your calls. Well, we're talking about old-time radio with John Tefteller, but how about some new-time television? That's right, Beyond Belief, our television program where you get it all, the unusual, the strange, the mysterious, the supernatural. We've got it all for you, and you can watch it. It's free for 10 days, and then you just decide, hey, I like this stuff. Just go to beyondbelief.com and sign up. You can also, by the way, during this 10-day period, look at all the shows you can. Stay home for the whole 10 days and watch television 24/7, plus the radio show, of course, beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, John Tefteller with us as we're talking about old-time radio and some of his old record collections as well. Did you really pay $37,000 for a record?
Yes, I did. And I was actually very happy to do it. That is a world record price, no pun intended, but it was a world record price for a 78 RPM phonograph record. It was a record by Tommy Johnson, who's a very famous classic Delta blues singer from the 1920s. And there was only one other copy of that record previously known to exist. It was in completely poor condition. You could hear it, but it didn't sound very good at all.
Scratchy.
You could hear it. Yeah. The copy that turned up for sale was in excellent condition, and it sounds amazing. And yes, I was happy to get that because now it can finally be properly remastered and re-released to the world so that people can enjoy it.
How did you find it, John?
Well, this one was simple. This one was listed on the internet on eBay. Other records are much harder to find because you have to actually go dig them out of barns and attics and yeah. flea markets and warehouses. But every once in a while, something like this will appear on the internet, although very, very rarely will something of this world-class caliber appear on the internet. It did, and the bidding was spirited, and I wound up being the high bidder, and I will have it released later this year, as part of our Blues Images calendar series. We include a CD with each of the calendars, and it'll be on the next CD for the next issue this year.
What did the record, what do you think it sold for originally? When it first
came out? I know it sold for about 50 cents.
50 cents?
Yes. But those early blues records are extremely desirable, and there are some of them that we're not even sure still exist. And later on, before we get off the topic of old-time radio and get to the blues stuff and all that, if we do that, I want to talk about some of the records that are missing and make a plea with your audience that if anybody out there has any of this stuff, we need to get it remastered and re-released, and it could be worth a lot of money.
I got to check Mom's collection. I don't know what she's got there. Well,
if she was into blues, you might have something.
She was, but I don't know.
Well, you better check, and that's what I would like everybody in your audience to do. Check those old records, and we're looking for blues records from the 1920s and 30s. Really old stuff.
Man, that's amazing.
Now, they're not all worth that kind of money, but there are some that are.
Do you think the people who sold this record that went for $37,000, were they in shock, do you think?
Absolutely. I went to pick it up. I actually flew east to pick it up. It was in South Carolina. The guy that found it actually found it at an estate sale outside of Columbia, South Carolina.
Man.
He didn't pay much of anything for it. He recognized the name. He knew it was blues. He knew it probably had some value, but he started it out with an opening bid of $500 on eBay. And within a day, it had reached $10,000. And by the time the auction actually ended, it was just over $37,000.
So there are some serious collectors out there like you who know the value of this stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, what makes it so rare and so needed?
Well, what makes it so rare is that there were very few of them sold to start with. and the masters don't exist anymore. They've all been destroyed. So because so many people, so many of the rock and roll musicians out of the 60s and 70s and even some of the musicians today, they look at the blues as the beginnings of rock and roll. And they want to go back and hear what those early blues records sounded like. And there's been a lot of those early blues records that have inspired the rock and rollers of the 60s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s, and all that.
I know Elvis Presley was influenced by this, wasn't
it? Correct. Yeah. Elvis was influenced. The Beatles were influenced. The Rolling Stones.
Chuck Berry
was influenced. Cream, Eric Clapton, Jack White from the White Stripes is the most recent example of it. There's a load of these musicians that their big thing is listening to these early blues records. And there's quite a number of them that are unaccounted for. We know they were made. We know that they were released to the public. And yet no copy seems to exist. Or if a copy exists, there's only one. And it's battered to the point where you can barely hear it. So my job, and it's a weird kind of a thing, but my job is to go around and find these things.
All right, make the plea. Tell people what they need to look for.
Well, you need to look for blues records from the 1920s and early 30s. The best and most collectible label from that time was a label called Paramount. And Paramount was a company that was run by a furniture company, and they were out of Port Washington, Wisconsin. They sold a lot of records in the Chicago area, down in the southern states, and across the USA. And they had some of the very best in the early blues records. And there's a number of them that simply are unaccounted for, and we would love to find. Willie Brown is one of the singers. Willie Brown played with Robert Johnson. Willie Brown played with Son House and Charlie Patton. And he's a legendary guy, but he made two records for the Paramount label that don't seem to exist anywhere. And I have a standing offer out there of $50,000 for either one of those records if somebody can get me a copy in playable condition.
Wow. Mom, please have it. Please.
She's Willie listening. Brown on Paramount. And the title I need, there's two titles I need. Kicking in My Sleep Blues is one, and Grandma Blues is the other one. And they're both on the Paramount label. So everybody search your attics, search your record collections, search everywhere and find those records. Willie Brown on Paramount, Kicking in My Sleep Blues, and Window Blues. $50,000 reward for either one in playable condition.
That is amazing. And you know what? Somebody might find it. Somebody
That's why
may
I'm
have
saying it.
You never know. And your website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. My mom threw away my comic book collection that I started in the 50s and my baseball card collection that I had in the 50s.
And both of those things can be tremendously valuable these days.
Absolutely.
And records are the same way. Records can either be very valuable or not valuable at all.
Like, let's say a record, an original record by Elvis Presley. Would that be worth anything?
Only if it's the Sun records. The Sun label records were the first records he made. He made five records for Sun in Memphis, and then his contract was sold to RCA, and he sold millions of records after that. Most of the RCA records are not particularly valuable. The early Sun records are not particularly rare. They turn up more now than they used to, so I don't exactly call them rare records anymore because you can buy them almost any day of the week on the Internet, but they're somewhat spendy, anywhere from a few hundred dollars to by about $10,000 for one of those if they're in perfect condition. But it's not so much the Elvis. The way it works with records is the least popular they were when they came out, the more popular and the more valuable they
really?
Are now.
If they would only know it.
Well, it's logical if you think about it. If something was a hit record and something sold a lot of copies, there's a lot of copies still out there.
Oh, sure.
A lot of them have been destroyed. There's still a lot of them out there. But especially the black blues and the rhythm and blues and some of the more obscure rock and roll and hillbilly rock and roll, all that stuff didn't sell real well when it first came out. And the less it sold, the more obscure it is, the more potentially valuable it is now.
Less is more, isn't it?
Yes. So what we don't want is we're not looking for big band records. We're not looking for classical or opera or show tunes or any of those kind of easy listening records that the majority of the country would have been into when they first came out. We're looking for the more obscure things that a much smaller percentage of the population would have been into when they first came out, and therefore they sold less, there's less of them available now, and the value is great.
So the Robert Johnson ones probably aren't worth as much as somebody who's more obscure.
Well, no, Robert Johnson records are actually quite valuable simply because he's such a legendary figure. And so many people would like to own one record by him that just about any original Robert Johnson 78 in any kind of playable condition is going to be at least $500 to $1,000. And then if you get into really nice copies of Robert Johnson records, they can be multiple thousands of dollars.
That is so. All right, it's a good project for people just to fish around and look and. Who knows where they are? And, you know, there could be people, elderly people, for example, who have them stashed away. They may never have looked at them for 40 years.
John. Well, and that's the thing. The kind of person that would have some of these really rare things does not realize what they have. They have records that they inherited from grandma, grandpa, great uncle, whatever. But they don't really understand whether they're valuable or not. And for the most part, they're just sitting in a closet, sitting in a garage, sitting in a barn, sitting in a basement. And they need to be looked at by someone who knows what they are, who can tell them if they have something of value. And that's what I do all over the country, in small towns, big towns, everywhere.
If somebody were to take one of these records into the pawn shop in Las Vegas that they have that TV show, would they call on someone like you to come and tell them how much it's worth?
Well, I'm not sure that those guys are really hip to early blues 78s. I know that they know a little bit about rock and roll from the 50s and 60s, but the early blues stuff is a very, very select market, and it takes a very, very special person to be able to help determine the value on those things. So I'm not so sure that those guys would know. I do this all over the country all the time. My phone rings off the hook all the time with people calling to see if they have anything of value. 90% of them don't, but that 10% that do, they can make themselves a real lot of money in a real quick fashion.
Outside of this story here where you paid $37,000, is there a story that is so memorable for you in terms of a discovery of an old record?
Well, not necessarily a record, although there was a record involved, and we haven't really got into this too much yet, but if you think that the records of early blues musicians are valuable and are hard to find, try finding photographs of those musicians.
Hmm.
Those are even harder to find.
So those
might not be as valuable, per se, but they're harder to find. And one of the biggest discoveries of things like that I had was in 2002, buying a whole collection of original advertising material and photographs from the Paramount Record Company in Port Washington, Wisconsin. The company had been out of business for years and years and years, but they had left some file cabinets in an old building, and some people were told to throw those file cabinets into the trash can and destroy the material. And they just couldn't bear to do it. They thought it was too cool.
Yeah.
They saw these pictures of early blues musicians and ads for these early records, and they thought the stuff was really cool. And so they saved it, and I got a hold of one of them, and I wound up going back to Port Washington, Wisconsin, and buying this whole library of stuff. And in it was the only known photograph of Delta bluesman Charlie Patton. And it shows him sitting in a chair holding his guitar. And no one had ever seen that photograph before. It's probably the most important photograph now in blues history. And it was sitting in a file cabinet in an abandoned building in Port Washington for years and years and years until it was discovered.
What kind of instruments did they play most of the time, John?
Well, the rural musicians, the ones from the Mississippi Delta and the smaller towns in the South, tended to play guitars. But the more uptown musicians, so to speak, would play pianos, and sometimes you'll hear kazoos on records,
violins. Wow!
But mostly it's a guitar or piano thing with the blues musicians.
How about horns? Horns at all?
Well, by the time you get to horns, you're talking about jazz or kind of uptown city blues, and
okay.
that gets into the 50s and the 40s. We're talking about the really early primeval period of blues, which was very rural, very down-home type music. There weren't a lot of instruments, and it's a very sort of gut-wrenching music, and that's what the attraction to it is. It sounds unique and different and unlike most anything else you will have heard.
You're talking to a lot of younger people tonight on this program, and when we get back into some of the old-time radio shows, and we're going to play the clips next hour, John, I mean, they may sit back and say, come on, who cares about these old-time radio shows? What would you say to them?
Well, I think they need to listen to the clips a little bit before they make a judgment like that. The way I look at it is this. When I was born, radio was pretty much off the air. I'm 55 years old, and most old-time radio ended in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yes.
So I didn't hear any of it when I was a kid. But I will tell you that if you go back as a historian and as someone who collects all this stuff, and you listen to what survives from those radio days, some of it is absolutely stunning, and some of it is not so good at all. And I think I'm a pretty objective listener because it's not nostalgia with me. It's more of a historical thing. And so I can tell you that the very best radio shows stand up to the test of time 100%. And then some of the others that people may remember fondly because they sounded good when they were a youngster, they're not so good now. They're kind of cornball and dated. But the very best of it sounds incredible. And you can get some real entertainment out of the very best of it. And I think the shows that I sent you to play, when we get to those, are some of the very best and most captivating programs from that period. So I think the listeners of all generations will enjoy hearing the little bits of them that you've selected.
John, some of those programs were done before live audiences, weren't they?
Yes. Not everything was done before a live audience. Most of the comedy shows were done before a live audience, and some of the dramatic shows were done before a live audience. But some of them had no audience at all. It varied by the program.
And you're right. It was live programming. They had one shot to do it and do it right, didn't they?
And they were very, very professional. The actors that played in those shows, some of them were big-name movie stars. They would have Clark Gable and Jimmy Stewart and Boris Karloff and the different famous different famous film stars would come and do radio.
Right.
But they also had a whole secondary string of performers that are names that are probably not at all well-known today because they were all primarily just radio actors and actresses, but they were the best in the business, and in some cases they were better than some of the big stars on radio.
When television started to grow from its infancy, they killed a lot of these radio shows, didn't they?
Yes. As soon as television got a foothold in America to where the television set became more affordable to buy, which would have been around the time of the late 40s and the early 50s and then into the mid 50s, by that point the audiences were turning away from radio and were turning to the more new novelty of television. And a lot of the early television is quite good and quite collectible as well and quite rare. I don't really collect that stuff, but there are people out there that do. And some of those are just as hard to find as the radio shows because they were either not recorded at all or recorded on cheap kinescopes that were long since destroyed. So early television is a whole different thing, and I'm not really an expert on that. But radio definitely got pushed aside when television came in. I noticed you played that song at the opening of the first hour, Video Killed the Radio Star, and that's 100%
true.
Video or television did indeed kill the radio star.
John, when we come back in a moment, we're going to start playing some of these clips from these old-time radio shows. We'll give everybody truly a delight, and then we'll talk about those shows and their popularity as well. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM.